would you please tell me what title you want me to use in introducing you tonight?
I'm the National Chairman for Government Affairs for Vietnam Veterans of America, which is the only congressionally chartered veteran service organization in America specifically charged with representing the interests of Vietnam veterans.
What branch of the military were you in?
U.S. Army. Joined just a few weeks after I turned 17. Graduated high school. That was in 1963. And suddenly, obviously, in 65, I found myself on the way to Vietnam. 1st Cav Division was the first American division to go to Vietnam. And I spent a year there. I was a medic with the 1st Cav 229th Assault Helicopter Battalion. Obviously, it was a very important point in my life, but as I often say, it was not my life. It was something that I'd had an experience with, and some good and some bad, but I came home and have been involved in veterans issues for about two decades now.
Vietnam veterans came home to a kind of a divided, angry country. Veterans were not as supported as World War II veterans were when they came back. How difficult did that make the transition to civilian life?
Well, it was very difficult for me because when I came back, which was in 1966, we were unaware of what was going on politically within the United States. We were totally unaware of this. And when we showed up, we were counseled that we should be careful, we should not wear our uniforms, and we were wondering, what are you talking about? Where aren't we going to have our parade? You know, so isn't something supposed to happen here? I mean, we'd all been socialized in post World War II in Korea, and so we sort of intuitively had those expectations, and here we've been told, no, you don't want to have those expectations. And for many of us, I went and tried to join the Veterans of Foreign Wars. I was a veteran. I'd been in a foreign war, and they advised me that I was not a legitimate veteran of a foreign war because they did not consider Vietnam to be a legitimate war. And that was really, for me, the first time I began to wonder, what the hell is going on? And then I began to watch TV and would see what was going on. 6 months, I reenlisted. I was not able, I mean, I went from combat in Vietnam to the streets of San Francisco in less than 24 hours. And they didn't have a sort of calm down time or an opportunity to adjust time. Got to remember, in World War II, when you came back, and also in Korea for the most part, you came back on a boat, and you were on a boat for two or three or four weeks in some cases. So there was a long process of sort of readjusting. The chaplains came around and visited with you. We didn't have that. I literally got a call on a forward deployment. Get on the chopper, come back to the base camp, got on the C-130, flew to the airport, got on the plane, and I was in San Francisco. And I didn't even get a chance to pack my duffel bag. That's how quickly that happened. So it I had a hard time adjusting. I got a job, but one of the first jobs I got was working in a grocery store. And a cashier there, and this was sort of the tip of the iceberg for me, a cashier there suddenly found out I was a medic in Vietnam, and she had lost her son in Vietnam. And of course, to her, it was my fault. And it created a huge disturbance in the store. I was in shock. I had no idea what she was talking about. I just decided it was better for me to go back into service, which I did, and I spent 3 more years in service, 2 years of those in Korea. And that's really where I began to adjust back into the world.
Nearly 60,000 Americans died in combat in Vietnam, more than 150,000 injured, and many have died since of war-related trauma through alcohol, drugs, high-risk, dangerous jobs. It took a long time before the impacts of Agent Orange or PTSD was even recognized and understood at all. Now, 40 years down the road, how would you say Vietnam vets are doing today?
Vietnam vets are doing very well. The majority of Vietnam veterans, when they came home, one of the things that we know now, which is an interesting story, is they put all that stuff behind them. They got into families, they got into jobs, they got into careers, and they began to adjust, reassimilate. What's happening, which is fascinating, is many of Vietnam veterans are now retiring, facing divorce, and suddenly we have this significant spike in post-traumatic stress because the post-traumatic stress they brought home with them from Vietnam was suppressed and sort of pushed back in their brain and not dealt with. And then suddenly, because their world has changed, it percolates up and causes significant emotional trauma. And unfortunately, we've seen a lot of suicide as a result. So that's an interesting thing that we're finding. I was just meeting with the new Alaska Director for Veterans Health with the VA, and we're talking about those kinds of challenges up here. The other thing is our first priority in national legislation this year, and I'll be in D.C. in 2 weeks presenting this to Congress, is what we call the legacy of Agent Orange. Now, when the Agent Orange issue was going on, I was oblivious to it. I was working for President Reagan in the Department of Interior, and I was not aware of what was going on there because I was focused on other issues. But over the last year, because this issue has percolated up to my national committee, I've sort of reacquainted myself with something I was unaware of. I was unaware of Agent Orange even in Vietnam, and to my knowledge, I never had an exposure. But we now know we have four generations of progeny from Vietnam veterans who are born with severe birth defects. I'll be meeting with two women in D.C. In 2 weeks, both of whom are children of Vietnam. And now we have, as I said, four generations of progeny from Vietnam veterans who have significant birth defects. Our effort in Congress this year and next year is to get Congress to recognize that these are the new wounded of Vietnam. We're not asking for money. We're asking, one, that they be recognized, and secondly, that somebody pay attention to the effects of dioxin exposure multi-generationally. We now know, according to the science reports that we're receiving, that male sperm was altered as a result of exposure. That doesn't present itself before discharge. It didn't present itself for maybe 5-10 years. Maybe it's unknown. It's the ability not to be able to conceive is another ramification of dioxin exposure. So this is one of the interesting, Senator Begich had one of his staff go to Vietnam last year, and she called me and says, my God, this is not over. This is real. This is ongoing. And she went across Vietnam, and I've been there many times since the war, and seeing the legacy of Agent Orange there with the enormous amount of homes and hospitals and schools specifically set up for the survivors of Agent Orange.
How do the services offered to veterans compare in Alaska to the rest of the country? Is this a good place to be a veteran?
Alaska is a very good place to be. I've been working, as I said, on veterans issues for 2 decades. We have had... We're very blessed with a congressional delegation, even though they're split in party, that is 100% behind veterans and veterans' needs and veterans' issues. Lisa Murkowski, Mark Begich, and Don Young, I know them personally, have known them for many, many years. When I'm back there, we always meet and we talk about what's going on. There's Lisa in particular lately has been really pushing the rural health care for veterans and passed a law and has made significant advantage. One of the great things about Susan Yeager, our new VA director for health care in Alaska, she put that program together over 2 years, so she knows rural Alaska. We had the secretary up here last year, and the secretary said, you know, I get it. This is not rural. This is remote. And we've been telling people this for some time. So we're in a very good place. Now, that doesn't mean it's perfect. We have a lot of needs up here. But our veteran service officers who work for veterans organizations are out, strongly supported by the state of Alaska. We have an extraordinary state director in Verde Bowen who works for the state. It's clearly the best we've had since the inception of the position. Does a wonderful job, and as you see, the legislature continues to be very focused on meeting the needs of veterans. And as we often say, as I had one state senator some years ago say to me, well, you know, you guys are just another welfare group. And I said, excuse me, Senator, these are services that were earned by service and sacrifice. These are not services that are given due to our income status. Now, if you're a disabled veteran, you have a priority within the veteran healthcare system. If you're a financially challenged veteran, then you can come through another class within that system. But no, we have a very good system here. Our wait times are very short. If a veteran has a problem, they pick up the phone. I just dealt with a gentleman, picked up the phone and called me. I was doing an interview on another radio show. Within 3 days, his situation was corrected. And I find Susan and Verdi and all these people to be enormously responsive and absolutely dedicated to serving the veterans of our state and their families. And let me point out, it's not just the veteran that serves. My son spent 4 years in Iraq. It's the family that serves. It's that little girl he never saw for 4 years that serves. And one of the things I say when I give speeches in community settings, first thing I say is, how many service members do we have in the audience? And they stand, and I say, how many family members do I have in the audience who have a service member on active duty, guard or reserve? And they stand. And then I say, how many people are here are veterans, and how many are families of veterans? In Alaska, it's almost every time a majority of the people in the room. It's one of the things that's wonderful about our state. Alaska embraces veterans in a very loving way. Many people will tell you that are active duty and military, this is where they want to retire. This is where they want to retire. Go ahead, I'm just turning this off.
Okay. It's interesting to hear you characterize it as good, that the services are good. There's new statistics out today from the Center for Investigative Reporting that find that veterans are waiting for help. When you break out the numbers by state, Alaska has more than 2,700 vets waiting for disability benefits. Their average wait time is nearly a year, and for first-time filers, well over a year. Is this an emerging problem? Is this chronic, or how do you see this?
This is a chronic problem, and I have great empathy for the secretary and his efforts to try to deal with this, and the undersecretary, a young woman, former general, who is attempting to deal with this problem. This is a huge problem. This is not an easy problem. The conversion from paper to digital happens at this time, at this point in time. And this is one of the greatest criticisms veteran service organizations have of the Veterans Administration. In fact, Senator Begich was sort of being a little bit undelicate with the undersecretary the other day at a Senate hearing and saying, you know, we're now at a point where almost a million claims that are in waiting. How long? Some of these take well over a year. Some of these take 2 or 3 years. I have two Alaskans that were finally received their compensation for significant life-threatening harm as a result of service in Vietnam. And they have been waiting for 20 and 30 years. One of the things that happens in this process, and one of the reasons why we're trying so hard to have what's called the seamless transfer of records from DOD to VA. Of course, DOD has a computer system that doesn't talk to the VA computer system, so they're trying to find an interface to make that work, which will help. And we've argued that every service member who leaves service, their medical file should be immediately transferred for the VA, and we recommend that every veteran, whether they have a disability or not, whether they have a need or not, go to the VA and get registered, because they never know. The great tragedy for me is I get calls from a mom or a wife and says, my husband's sick. Can you help me? And they're not already registered with the VA. It takes months and months and months to get them to the point where we can get them registered, get them set up, get their claim put together, find the documentation. Are you kidding me? Trying to the documentation for Vietnam era? It's very difficult. This is a transition between a paper world and a digital world. We're going to be talking about this with the House and Senate committees next month and with a number of the key leaders in Congress and speaking with the secretary about it. And I believe and I have confidence that there is a significant effort to try to get this fixed. Will it be fixed within my lifetime? I don't have a high degree of confidence. But the secretary has said it will be done by 2015. He must have some reason for saying that. But frankly, we've been hearing that for over 20 years.
You mentioned your son. What is it like for you to see the new generation of veterans that's being created as a result of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Oh, you asked me a difficult question. First of all, having a son go to war was very difficult for me. I certainly supported him in his choice to do that. And his first tour over there, I spent a lot of time seeing a counselor because I was having a hard time with it. And my son, who's about 6'7" and about 350 pounds, is this monster guy. he was in the infantry, and he said, "What do you want? You know, what am I going to do?" And they said, "Go over there and pick up the biggest gun you can carry." And so that's what he carried. He carried the biggest machine gun he could carry. The real tragedy in this, and what I have learned as a result of finding out what's going on over in the Middle East and what's going on in the Department of Defense, and this is one of the reasons why so many people are leaving service and so many people are joining political organizations such as the Libertarian Party, because what happens is they get over there and find out that they're not there to win a war. They're there to police a community. And that's not what the military is designed to do. It sounds familiar to me because that's what we ended up doing in Vietnam. You know, we could fly to a certain spot in the on the map, but the bad guys over there were shooting us. We couldn't do anything. And it's enormously frustrating. Let me tell you a story. Young man sitting on a Bradley, 30 caliber machine gun. He is the last stopping point on a roadblock. And his orders are, anybody that comes through that's not approved, you stop. You must stop them. Because if they get through us and get to you, then they've got to be bad guys, and you got to stop them. So his job is sitting on that Bradley and watching the traffic come through and go through these checkpoints. It's to stop whatever goes through. Nothing happens for a couple of days. He's sitting there, and all of a sudden he notices people running around screaming and hollering, and this car is coming through all of these barriers and weaving around and through. It's obvious this car is not going to stop. It gets into his field of fire, and he stops it. And, of course, he gets down off his Bradley with everybody else and runs to see what's going on with this car. Why would this car do this? It's a man and his wife and three kids. Now, can you imagine the emotional problem my son had at that point? And then he was told that he was on house arrest pending investigation. And he sat in his barracks waiting. And he called me from Iraq to say, "Dad, am I in trouble?" Now, he said to say, "I don't think so. Talk to your NCOs, find out what's going on." And finally, about 5 days later, he called me and said, "I'm okay." Now, think of the emotional trauma that young man went through. One, for what he had to do. And then secondly, for the way his country treated him as a result of doing what he was supposed to do under orders. And as a result of that, he left the service. I hear those kinds of stories all the time from our young veterans. In fact, I'm looking for a way to find young veterans and sit down and talk to them about their decisions about leaving service and their decisions after leaving service about what they want to do with their lives. And I hear these stories constantly. Why do they send us over there? Why won't they let us win? Why don't they let us do our job? You have a PFC with 17 points, yes, remember, with respect to the rules of engagement before he pulls the trigger. It's insane, absolutely insane. So there's a lot of similarities with these young veterans and Vietnam veterans. And one of the fascinating things that's happened, of course, many of these veterans that are over there now, the new veterans, are the sons and daughters of Vietnam veterans. And they have an affinity with us. Unfortunately, Vietnam Veterans of America is a last man standing organization and has decided to be that. And when our last person dies, hopefully, we'll be able to hand somebody the keys of what we've been able to build over the last couple of decades.
Alaska has the highest number of veterans in the country, and I believe that's particularly true of Vietnam vets.
That's very true of Vietnam vets.
Why is that? Why do you think that is, that there's so many Vietnam veterans here?
One of the interesting things about Vietnam veterans, because of what happened to us when we came home, is we just want to isolate, which is a real struggle for us that deal with veteran services. And you go to a village, you go to a rural part of Alaska, and there's some guy living in a boat that hasn't been in the water for 20 years, and he hasn't been out of there, and he has a wheelchair, and he can't move around. And we find these guys all the time, and they've just decided to go out and isolate. They simply want to separate themselves from their community, from their culture, from where they grew up. Great tragedy, and as the article I gave you today, is that America has learned as a result of Vietnam veteran experience that when we come home from war, it's the embrace of our nation, it's the embrace of our community, it's the embrace of our families that really begins the healing. That's where the healing begins. We lie to ourselves a lot. We tell ourselves lots of stories about what we did and what we had to do to survive and carry out our mission. But when you get on that plane and you're coming home, you begin to think about that. And if the country and the community and the families and the churches, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and the service organizations do not embrace these guys and these gals, it's going to be hard. And that's what happened to us. And we, our motto as an organization is never again will one generation of veterans abandon another. And we do that every day. And that's why we serve every veteran, not just Vietnam veterans.
What does it mean to you that tomorrow will be the first day designated by our governor to honor not just vets generally, but Vietnam vets in particular?
Well, this is a piece of legislation that I've been working on for 3 years. I work on lots of bills in Juneau. We were unable to get it through last time, and there were some corrections. They got the date wrong. They had the 30th. Anyway, it's called the Making Sausage, and I've been doing it for a long time. So we started over again this session, and we were delighted to have the new Fairbanks legislator pick this up and walk with it. I was delighted. We had a number of Vietnam veterans go down to Juneau for the ceremony. I couldn't go down because I was tied up. We are one of, I think now, 20-some states that have made March 29th forever Vietnam Veterans Day. We have legislation in Congress. We expect the president to announce an executive order tomorrow making March 29th Vietnam Veterans Day. But we have a bill in Congress, hopefully will pass during this Congress, if they do anything, that will make nationally March 29th Vietnam Veterans Day forever. And what the purpose of this is not just to remember Vietnam veterans, although obviously this is an important part. We want, and it's one of the things that I was appreciative of the article that I gave you, it lists all the fallen from Alaska. We have a lot of families in Alaska today that lost a son or daughter or a grandson or an uncle. And so this is a day for us to remember them. We have the smallest number of casualties of any other state, 52 or 58, I think. But it's also our allies. We spoke of Agent Orange. There are Vietnam veterans in Australia, New Zealand, South Korea who are suffering with the exposure to Agent Orange. They're all Vietnam veterans. And there's also the tragedy of the Vietnamese. As I said, I've been back there a number of times. My wife, on my 50th birthday, took me back to Vietnam. That was quite an experience. And I was able to stand on that spot outside of Pleiku where I lost all my friends and I was hit. But that was also an enormously healing event. And after that, the ghosts that I had carried around with me for years were effectively gone. So I encourage a lot of Vietnam veterans to go back. My best friend who died last year never did, and it's one of the things I'm sorry he never got to do. But I really encourage Vietnam veterans to go back. And the best thing to do is go back with other veterans from Vietnam, which is what I did, which is very, very helpful.
How do you plan to celebrate tomorrow?
The problem with, I guess it's a medic's legacy. The problem with me as a medic is when I think about it, I see faces. You know, when men are dying, they say one or two things. Tell my wife I love them. Tell my daughter I'm sorry. Tell my mom I love her. It's a moment that is just etched on the front of your brain, and it never goes away. With a lot of counseling and a lot of work, you're able to manage it, but it never goes away, and I hope it never does, because those are important memories to me. When I go to the wall in Vietnam and I see their names there, I remember who they are. So that's probably what I'll do. It is not a day that I would say will be joyous. It will be solemn. It'll be appropriate. But I will also be very proud.
Thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome.